Welcome back.
Hope you had a good summer.
These won't be taken, so you can move up if you want.
Oh. No.
Or not.
We're not going to have a...
Yes, well, we will accept. I forgot my computer.
Oh.
That's why we were talking about forgetfulness.
Oh.
I brought my power supply. I bought my remote. I brought the connecting cable. I just didn't bring the computer.
Well,
I got 3 out of 4, so
yeah.
The inferior function refuses integration.
Yeah.
I thought I'd just a very quick review of everything we've done for like five or 10 minutes. Hit the main images. Kind of get back. It's so easy that at least for me, to lose the thread of what we're doing.
Yeah.
So remember, we started the spirit of the time, the spirit of the depths. Then I think that what we basically did up to now is what I would call spirit in matter. Spirit in matter. For a long time, this question was spirit or matter. And some of those images were the descent into the cave and seeing the dead hero.
Are you talking that that's the part where it's spirit or matter?
Well, yeah, we're not even at that point yet. When he descends to the cave, he doesn't know what he's doing, but he sees that dead hero, which would be the heroic ideal which sees spirit and matter as separate. He doesn't realize that yet. And then he has the image of shooting Siegfried. So that's the hero shot. And again, the old worldview saw spirit and matter as separate.
Yep.
You're a spiritual person. That's good. You're a material person. That's bad. We still have it. Another thing to remember about Siegfried means victory, Sieg, Fried, peace. So it means peace through victory. But don't believe it. It really means peace, victory, which dominates and imposes a peace. It's Hitler's bringing peace to Europe. It's pure power. It's silencing any dissidence and certainly any spontaneous creativity. So that's the power drive of the West that Jung was overcoming. We still aren't through it. When a football player makes $90 million in 5 years and we close schools, that's power, you see. We're still not through it. Okay, then the images of the separation of spirit and matter appear in the images of Elijah and Salome. Salome is the voluptuous one. Elijah is wise. And unfortunately, Jung is realizing they come together. And so at this point, it's beginning to dawn on him that you can't separate desire and knowledge. Real wisdom comes out of living through your desire, through what you want. The next big image then, hello, was the black snake that encircled Jung, and Salome then begins to see. So the sight of Salome would mean he's beginning to get conscious of the nature of his desirousness. And the snake he talked about as the winding way of life. So he's beginning to accept that life requires these torturous routes, namely living through his, I think at this time, must have been tremendous eroticism. And don't forget, he had just worked with Freud, who talked about eros. Goes to a castle in the forest where he sees an old man and a young woman. Same idea. The two eros and logos together, but as two separate principles, though I think he's beginning to realize how they do belong together. Then we have the image of death. So what is happening is that polarity is dying. Or he is dying to the understanding that that polarity is a polarity. And one of the key features of his psychology is you get conscious through emotions. No emotions, no consciousness. It's in the fire of life that we learn. That's how spirit and matter are really two sides of the same coin. That at times is a very painful realization. Another way to put it is if you don't make your mistakes, you won't learn anything. But who likes making mistakes? Then, after that, we have the figure of Gilgamesh, which is where we are today. The big thing about Gilgamesh is he started out a jerk and ended up human. So, see, he's just the opposite of Siegfried, where Siegfried, the end point of Siegfried is domination. The end point of Gilgamesh is humanity. He becomes more humane throughout the story by his final loss. And that's where we stopped. Just a little more on Gilgamesh. He calls him Izdubar, same name. Which I think is relevant to Jung's psychology. And just a quick parenthesis, you know, as I'm learning along with you guys, so ideas occur to me along the way. And I think I asked myself, what are we doing here? And the answer is, we're looking at this material from two points of view. One, what was Jung going through? And two, how are these images the seed of his psychology? So what Jung was going through personally was the torment, I think, of his sexual desires. Until he realized, if I'm going to become conscious, I've got to go through them. That's the unity of spirit and matter. And so the death is the recognition, oh, this is the way I got to go. Now, that's Jung. What's it to do with his psychology? His psychology is dealing with the fact that we have to help people accept their desires in order to become conscious. That is a key feature of Jung. We don't try to sublimate desire. We try to learn through it. Okay, so now we're at Gilgamesh, who would represent now the beginning of that synthesis. Think of alchemy. We had the two opposites, and now we had the death, and the new image then is the synthesis. So another thing we're seeing is in this material is how opposites unite toward a synthesis. And that is, of course, a key feature of Jung's psychology. A little bit about Gilgamesh. The difficulty that Jung faces with Gilgamesh is he's partly right and he's partly wrong.
Which
he? He, Gilgamesh. He, Izdubar. Izdubar says, your science is poison to me. That's one of the big arguments they have. Western science is poison. Now, I think we're going to see in time Izdahar is the first manifestation of the self. So we could say the inadequacy of reason and science to help us understand the self. And even the destructive effect of science on the self. For example, I was talking to somebody this week, and this person has a new relationship, and a counselor told this person who is in a relationship with somebody who's just divorced, but you know, statistically, the first relationship after a divorce never works. Fuck you. Look at the murder that is doing to the passion that is trying to emerge. That reasonable approach doesn't leave any room for the fact that I may not be the average. I may be different. So that's Izdahar's complaint, and it's a valid one against science and reason, and I think we could say statistical thinking, the average, judging yourself by the average, which is what science does. On the other hand, Jung points out, hey, science got rid of polio, it's got rid of smallpox, it's got rid of infant eye disease. If you've ever traveled in the third world, that's one of the first things that strikes me, is you see children with really disturbed eyes. We've got rid of all that. So these guys are sort of now wrestling. And so another conflict has arisen with the emergence of the self, and I think what that's going to lead to is Jung's understanding of symbolic language. There is a language that can help us deal with the self, but it's not a linear language. But at this point, it still doesn't have that. And we stop then at 280. 279, I think. Yeah, no, at 280. Unfortunately, I forgot my darn computer. Carol had sent me an email. I thought I'd refer to that. Remember, you had sent me an email.
I do. I copied it out also.
I think it's the picture on, no, it's not. Yeah, I have.
I'll tell us.
I have the number here on the slide. I don't have the number in the book. Do you have the number in the book?
It's historiated initial 40.
40.
And that's on page
280.
It's on page 280, but we want to see the picture of the historiated initial.
Here
is, what page is it?
1040.
Oh, that image. And that's in our text, that's page
280. The text is 280, but the picture is on page 40. Does that make sense to everybody? Maybe you want to have a quick look at the picture, so because Carol has something to add to it.
So the picture, let's see. We had seen that image in the very beginning, and it's in the corners. And I thought to myself, well, what is that? And as best I can tell, it's stylized.
Why don't you guys have a look so you know what, or maybe pass it down so you know what she's talking about. Sorry about this.
Yeah.
Dragonfly. Yeah, dragonflies.
Yeah, and as far as I could tell, those are stylized dragonflies in the corner. And and also you'll see worms on either side. Mm-hmm. Those worms are tapeworms.
Mm-hmm.
Tapeworms. And I know they're tapeworms because look at the head. Mm-hmm. And I'll pass this around, which is the head of a tapeworm.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. So, anyway, I thought, now why tapeworms, why dragonfly larvae? Or nymphs, I should say. They're not larvae.
So they're young dragonflies?
Yes.
Yeah.
And at that stage, they live in water.
Okay.
Okay. So I thought, well, you know, he's attaching quotations from the East to a lot of what he's doing. He evidently is thinking about Eastern philosophy. And so I got to searching through the Indian myths for the dragonfly. And here is what they say about the dragonfly. This is from one of their philosophers, Bharad Bhaja. And he says, "Why should the mind be before and after every other thing? Because it can never be found in the world. You can open up any body, any element, with the finest of metal points. You can turn everything inside out and expose all that has been hidden until matter becomes a horror of dragonflies. To no end. You will never find so much as a trace, not even the tiniest of the mind. The banner of its sovereignty is this: it's not being there. No one can ever claim to have grasped it. It's like a dazzle on water. You can follow it, but however far you go towards it, it will always move the same distance away." So in my mind, Jung's use of the dragonfly is a intuition of the ultimate mystery of the mind and the unconscious, that you can never truly know what it is. And I think points to the fact that he maintains his ideas as hypotheses, which is very close to the Indian philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my conjecture, you know, because I looked all through Indian mythology, and this is the only reference to the dragonfly that I find. And I also looked through world myth, and of course the dragonfly is used. In Japan, it's courage, strength, and happiness. And, you know, the Northwest tribes, the Tlingit, for them, it's a symbol of transformation. And for in Uganda, it's a primordial female spirit. So all those things also mesh happily with this idea of an unknown factor, you know, the mind being something beyond our consciousness. And then the tapeworms, where are we starting today? What page?
280.
Well, maybe we haven't covered this yet.
Okay.
I didn't get to the end of our tape last time. But on 279 in our text, I thought, now why a tapeworm in there? And if you look in the right-hand column, the paragraph that starts, "Cheerful flowery meadows," this reminded me of the image of the tapeworm. He says, "Cheerful flowery meadows and lovely spring forests hemmed my path, but in the third night the heaviness came. It stood before me like a range of difficult cliffs full of sorrowful desolation, and everything tried to deter me from following my life's path. But I found the entrance and the narrow way. The torment was great, since it was not for nothing that I had pushed the two dissipated and dissolute ones away from me. I unsuspectingly absorb what I reject." And that, I think, speaks to me of a tapeworm. I absorb it, I eat it, but it's something that I would reject.
I see.
And it eats me from the inside. And then, yes.
And I'm wondering about 1913, if they knew that, if they had any forest, especially in the South, which you know is barefoot, they absorb into the skin, and they absorb the nutrients in the body.
Right. And then the next paragraph down, the one that starts, "So the path of my life," if we go down to the third sentence from the bottom, he says, "Since whatever I reject is nevertheless in my nature, I thought it was without, so I believe that I could destroy it. But it resides in me and has only assumed a passing outer form and stepped toward me." So he's talking about having ingested it, like we do with the tapeworm. And maybe we'll get to page 280, but then he openly talks about worms on 280.
Okay.
And I guess that's where we're going next.
Let me have a look at that picture again.
Did I pass around the picture of the tapeworm?
Yeah.
Do you see the head?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nice work. Thank you.
And what you said about the snake worm eating would be, see, I think he's wrestling with this affair with Tony Wolf, that if he doesn't live it, it's going to eat him from the inside anyway. It's either going to eat him from the outside or eat him from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he then, by living that out, he realized how, in the long run, how Eros contains a guiding spirit. So the worm would be, you know, the desire that would eat him if he doesn't follow it, and the dragonfly would be the spirit out of that experience. To me, that makes perfect sense anyway.
But in the beginning, we had the dragonfly when he's in the cave.
Yeah.
With the jewel, the opening, mm-hmm. before he enters the sea, the bloody stream. Mm-hmm. We have the dragonfly.
But we didn't have the worm, huh, at that point.
We have the snakes, which are also the worm.
Are
remember
the
when
in
he looks
picture?
In
yeah.
and sees the black sun,
yeah.
or the sun, is it a sun with the snakes coming at it?
Yeah.
They're the worms are there. And that's all in that same
yeah.
body of images in the beginning.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think that gets us to where we are. Let's pick up on top of 280. We did that paragraph, but I wanted to give you a little chart that I think might help digest this material, which doesn't get any easier. I wanted to rise, he wanted to sink. Here I am, fourth line down, I wanted to rise, he wanted to sink.
In the left-hand column?
Left-hand column, top.
Oh, yes.
I was dwarfish like a child, he was enormous like a powerful hero. Now, knowledge lamed me, while he was blinded by the fullness of the light. Now, we're going to see in a moment, the reason I'm taking a little time here, that it starts out that Jung is lamed, and I call it the self. Istvar is blind. But soon we're going to see that Jung goes from lame to blind, and the self goes from blind to lamed. Now this is, when I say the self, that's my interpretation, but I feel pretty safe in saying that. So Jung is getting his first glimpse of what he's later going to call the self. But it's a mess when it appears. Because he doesn't have a clue how to understand it. Again, my interpretation, to be lamed and to be blind, the first condition of Jung and the self, is the unconscious condition of the ego and the self. The unconscious ego is lame. The unconscious self is blind.
Unconscious ego and unconscious self.
Yeah. Unconscious Jung is lamed, is lame, and the unconscious self is blind. What do I mean? To be lame is when who you are hasn't developed yet. You are a small portion of what you can be. And so you're weak. That's the lame. The blind is the nature of the unconscious self to make these horrific demands. And I think the blindness at this point in Jung's life is the assault that his eroticism was having on him. And he's soon realizing that behind that assault is another factor, the self. But when the self is unconscious, it uses instincts to press itself on us with a disregard for whether we can take it or not. And that's the blindness of the self. It could be a depression. It could be strong passion. It could be a bankruptcy. It could be a divorce. The self wants its intent recognized. It doesn't care how you feel about it. And that, in that sense, it's blind to your needs. This is my attempt to understand it. As we'll see then in this page, what he's working on is that he goes from lame to blind. And by blind, in that case, I believe it's talking about trust. Not seeing where you're going, but trusting that you are going somewhere.
So you say the blindness, say that for me again.
It's like blind faith, but in the best sense.
Do you remember in the visions she had the one image of the blind wise man, and we talked about it as, as being able to focus on the inside and thinking about Jung's work is all about what is
that also makes sense. Yeah, very much.
Or being able to be guided from that inner place. You do have to be somewhat blind to the world
and to reason, because it doesn't always seem to make sense.
So that, in this case, that would psalm it would fit right into that initial blindness.
That's right. Let me see. Yeah. Right. All Salome is saying is go have an affair.
Right.
She doesn't care if it destroys his marriage or not.
So could we say the unconscious state of the self is narcissistic?
Yes. Definitely.
Could we say the same of the ego? Unconscious ego?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's put it as the realized self for a moment. Is in a way narcissistic in the sense that it has its agenda for your life, which you have to fulfill. And that will take precedence over human considerations. If you have to write a book, you have to write a book. And if your partner says, let's go to the cocktail party, and you say, no, I want to write a book, the partner will perceive that as being self-centered. Why do you always have to get your way? But it's not your way. It's the self's way. Now, when that isn't conscious, You don't go to the cocktail party because you don't feel like it. Without, in both cases, there's disregard of the other person's feelings. But in the conscious case, you are giving feeling to something. It's just not in that relationship. I think that's how it works.
Okay. So it's in relationship to itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm working with a guy who is a writer, and I won't say the name, but he went to another Jungian, nobody you know, I don't think, nobody around here, but a big Jungian name, and for marriage counseling, and the Jungian said, you know, all this writing here is you're just taking energy away from the marriage, that's your narcissism. Yeah. Well, damn near killed the guy. In a way, it was taking energy away from the marriage. But he was serving something else.
Would you go so far as to say that the human being sacrifices themselves?
Yeah.
And for something greater?
Right.
And your own human life could have been much better without this?
Absolutely.
So,
yeah,
I suppose, you know, when you talk about following the pattern of your fate, it's not, in effect, it's not really your fate, it's
exactly
a piece of whatever would evolve this thing we call the self.
Yeah, and whatever will evolve humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you're withdrawing from the cocktail party and you're writing your book, a simple example, that you are producing something for other people.
You know, that's not a very good sales point for the self, is it?
No.
yeah. Not exactly the nature of most people these days to want to do something like that.
I can tell you how this situation with other analysts resolved itself, but it's quite a vulgar story. You up for a vulgar story?
Yes.
True story. So that just gave his wife ammunition, which was picked up by the mother-in-law with equal force, and they were complete snobs, belittling, you know, his right. It's true, it's vulgar, but it's true. One day, the wife and the mother-in-law were at a meal or something at his house with other family members. And in their so-called high culture attitude, the guy's dog came in, sat down in front of the mother-in-law, proceeded to give himself oral sex, had an orgasm all over the mother-in-law's shoes. And the guy thought, maybe my instincts are at odds with these people. That's how deeply this stuff works. Well, you've been involved with Jung far too long. No, I'm with you. I think it is miraculous. But that started to dawn on him how the instincts and the family were at odds. Yeah. So you can see how something deeper supports that creative process. That's one of the weirdest stories I've ever heard. I heard it in my own ears.
So he and his wife both went together.
They were in marriage counseling with this Jungian analyst.
Jungian analyst for marriage counseling?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This is way before, this is when there were like three or four analysts in the country. This is quite a few years ago. I'd love to tell you the name, but I better not. So that's what we're going to be working with on this page. Lame to blind and blind to lame. And the power then
of the self, which can be destructive to the status quo. And since we have to live in the world, we have to try to mitigate that. Yet, on the other hand, as you can see from the dog story, has a terrific power.
It illustrates the difference between the spirit of the times and the spirit of the day.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll start then that I was a child. So in the face of all of these demands that we've just talked about, he is saying, I'm still a child. It's not the divine child, it's the infantile child. And I'm being blown about by the wind. And then he says, I was a boy. Same thing. Now, I understand what comes as his beginning to grasp the nature of the inner power which the self manifests. I did not anticipate the powerful, blind, and immortal one who wandered longingly after the sinking sun, who wanted to cleave the ocean down to its bottom so he could descend into the source of life. That which hurries toward the rising is small. That which approaches the descent is great. He who descends is great, and it would be easy for him to smash me. Now, by that descent, I understand it means, or it's anticipating, his realization that the self has to be made real. In that terms, that little diagram, that the self becomes lame, meaning its potential is diffused when we take its demands and put it into time and space. So when we write that book or take that public position or say our truth or contribute our gift, that is the descent of the self. I think biblically, too, there's not much in the Bible I really like, but one I do like is at the incarnation of Christ, Mary empties herself. It's the same idea. God who looks like the sun does not hunt worms, but the worm aims at the heel of the powerful one and will prepare him for the descent that he needs.
I wonder if that refers to the image of the tapeworm.
Yes, I think it does. Mm-hmm. Because, I wanted to mention, that historated initial I, that's where he says, I wondered. So it refers to him. That historated initial is to the letter I on page 279.
H-I-40.
H-I-40. He's saying, that's the I of ich.
Mm-hmm. So in the center is a snake. And he calls himself a snake to the God here, in relation to the God.
Hold that thought. Before we go any further, there is one footnote which I think is crucial to understand before we even get going. If I can find it. Go ahead to... 283 for a second. And look at footnote 114. Now I won't read you the first part because it's about an image we don't have yet. But he says that the footnote says that in the notes that Anneli Jaffe took from Jung to write Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung says that these sections
114?
Footnote 114.
Go down one...
Page 281.
Okay.
Yeah, two lines down on footnote 14. These sections, he says to Anil Yaffe concerning these sections, that some of the fantasies were driven by fear, such as the chapter on the devil, that's coming later, and the chapter on Gilgamesh, where we are now, Gilgamesh Ishtar. From one perspective, it was stupid that he had to find a way to help the giant, but he felt that if he didn't do so, he would have failed. He paid for the ridiculous solution through realizing that he had captured a god. We'll get to that later. Now, here's the sentence I want you to concentrate on. Many of these fantasies were a hellish combination of the sublime and the ridiculous. The reason I'm saying that, because a lot of what he says now, for a while, isn't going to make any logical sense. But I think if we take in the spirit of his groping, we have the right to critique and try to put it in a language that makes sense to our own minds.
Everything he's saying here makes sense to me if I look at it through the transformation of the god image.
Right. That's exactly right.
As though Ishtar is that aspect of the god image that has to be carried forward.
Yeah.
Which is always what the transformation calls for. Not to leave everything aside, but to take the essence, the transformed essence forward.
I agree totally. I think there's two things going on. These pages are the first place we see what later become Jung's understanding or idea of the transformation of the god image. That's the first thing. And secondly, we're seeing what happens to the god image as it becomes conscious. It is transformed as it becomes conscious in an individual life. That's one level. Another level is it changes, it is changing over the course of time. And that's why these pages are so confusing. He's doing about four things at the same time. And they're filled with logical contradictions. But don't let that discourage you, because he admits they're ridiculous.
He would be a poison to the old god image.
Yes.
Because he would have to strip it.
Right.
In effect.
Right. Yeah, so hold all these thoughts, but this is where we're going to go. We're sort of looking at the preview of the show, but this is where we're going.
Doesn't that happen to the individual too, though, as they're going through this process? You know, you're stripped down to your essence. That's what you're trying to get to. But that contains that little spark of the divine, too, so that is happening at the same time.
Same time, yeah. There's several transformations going on at the same time. And I think his head is just spinning with all of these ideas, and that's why it gets so confusing. I think these are some of the most confusing pages we've done so far. But if you understand, he knew, in retrospect, how upset he was and how confused he was. We don't have to feel that if we don't understand it logically, we don't understand it, because it's not understandable logically.
We get to be confused like he was.
We get to be confused like he was. So the worm aims at the heel of the powerful one and will prepare him for the descent that he needs. That's the sentence we got stuck on. I think the worm can be a couple of things here. It can be desirousness. On the one hand, desirousness comes from the self, but on the other hand, it's what makes us undertake the journey to become conscious of the self. And we'll see later that, like you were saying, Carol, that this poison is the old logos. So it's the old god image. And the old god image is poisonous to the new god image.
But the initial plants
from the very initial pictures we looked at of both poisonous and healing.
Right.
And I think at the end there, he's trying to indicate that it has to be just the right amount of poison. A little poison and a great one falls. You know, so too much, too soon, can kill it, the process. Not enough, and there's no change.
Yep. Alas, he is my dearest, most beautiful friend, he who rushes across, pursuing the sun and wanting to marry himself with the immeasurable mother as the sun does. I see that as the self becoming real, descending into the world. How closely akin, indeed, how completely one, are the serpent and the god. The word which was our deliverer has become a deadly weapon, a serpent that secretly stabs. So I think that's the old god image.
The Logos.
The old Logos.
Referring to to Christianity.
Yeah. I mean, just listen to the presidential debate now. Homosexuality, wrong. There was a conference with, who's it?
Ron Paul,
in which he was asked, if a person can't afford health care, should we just let them die? He said yes. See, that's the old God image.
And the audience cheered.
Yeah. See, the old God image is there's a right and a wrong, and so on. The new God image is less ready to make those sorts of judgments. And I think if you listen to debate, it is really a debate about values. And then ask yourself, in what are those values rooted? Rick Perry says, you know, God spoke to him. That's why he's running for president. Well, it's not the same God that speaks to me, I'll tell you that. Again, it's the conflict in God images, how we experience this stuff. So what we're dealing with now a little bit is the serpent. And I think on one hand, the serpent is the desire that leads you to the self. And on the other hand, the serpent is the destructive aspect of a self that is outmoded.
He uses the serpent, and just in this one paragraph, it seems like it just switches around.
Yeah, that's what's so hard here.
You know, first it's him, it's the old Logos, you know, it's Jung's ego, it's, you know.
But remember, this is pure fantasy material. Mm-hmm. This is just the unconscious coming out without him editing it. And then he later gives us confirmation when he says how sublime and ridiculous it was. And those of you who did the Nietzsche seminars, that's the way Nietzsche would have, within one sentence, two contradictions. The unconscious just spills this stuff out. It never bothers to say, is it consistent? We then have to add our critique to it to get the truth out of it that can live in a world of conscious egos. So no longer do outer opposites stand in my way. See, this, I think, is important, that sentence, because the opposites that we've seen in Salome and Elijah are coming inside. And that's what allows this dialogue with Izdebar to start taking place. And rise up hugely before me, and we block each other's way. The word of the serpent certainly defeats the danger. So there the serpent's a good guy. Just a minute ago, he's a bad guy. This is what's so hard to grasp about this stuff. But again, remember, that's the nature of the unconscious.
but my way remains barred, since I then had to fall from paralysis into blindness. That's what I put up there. Just as the powerful one fell into paralysis to escape blindness. Again, why bother? The thoughts themselves are damn confusing, but if you can imagine what Jung is spitting out will later be his recognition of the reciprocity between ego and self. That's what's going on. Don't get hung up on all these details. But see in this, oh, these two systems interact in a reciprocal way. One goes one way, the other goes the other way. I seem to be denied power while he is denied rebirth. But I escape the blindness that comes with power, and he escapes the nothingness that comes with death. And then I think the last line there is the important one. God climbs down to mortality. So there is the foundation of his work with the self, that the self as the God image isn't something we worship. It is something we try to make real. So acts of devotion are understanding your role in life and then living it. That is devotion. No longer worshiping in the traditional sense. All of that, I think, is in that paragraph. But it's a confused mess. The Mighty One fell... Now we have another... picture. It's on page 41. I think it's is it this here? Yeah. I don't know if there's any images in that that are really relevant for us. At least make a note that this next section where it's italicized and stuff. The whole thing is a story. But they're just little geometric figures.
I don't have anything to say about them. You might have something, but I think that they're more or less just shapes. Well, later those images form a temenos around something.
They do show up later on.
In image 45, they form a temenos.
Carol, here. You're observant.
Good job.
Okay.
Makes me think about, you know, when he's dealing with the anchorite.
Yes.
And he has to somehow take the abstraction of spirit forward. Mm-hmm. He can't just leave that. Mm-hmm. And to me, those abstract shapes are that abstraction of the cross. Mm-hmm. And he can't leave it behind. Somehow he's got to drag it forward with him while he's going to use it to protect that
That's
the essence of what he's bringing forward.
Exactly. That's kind of how it strikes me.
And they're all, well, maybe not.
What?
I was going to say they're somewhat symmetrical shapes.
Yes, some of them are.
And I wonder, again, this the big thing that he's having to reconcile with is he can't repress the unconscious. He can't repress the self. He can't just let it out on its own terms because, you see, it makes no sense. He's got to bring reason in to balance and be a bridge of the inner world to the outer world. That process can't occur rationally, but it also can't occur without some rationale.
because we live in a society based on reason.
So the images are green in a red border, so maybe that would be like the earthly passion, and then when it's the Tumenos over here, it's all colors. So it has mm-hmm. to be more extreme.
If we go through a transformation, I think on another page.
Yeah, we will go through a couple of transformations before we get there.
Right, there's that page before that where
right, they become more colorful.
If you look at those little shapes, they are not the same as, but they are in the same mood as Hebrew letters and numbers.
Yeah. Because mm-hmm. I thought as it went on, they looked like just the candelabra.
The one looks like a menorah.
Yeah,
I know. I made that note myself. There's a menorah that grows out of the egg. It looks like a menorah, yes. But it's mm-hmm. a stylized mm-hmm. tree.
Mm-hmm. I think. To me, in that first page where they're kind of red and green, they're very animated. To me, there's an energy in those.
The first mm-hmm. Elf thing.
Mm-hmm. Like he's taken what's alive out mm-hmm. of the God image, the old God image, and he's carrying that essence. They seem animated to me, maybe.
He's written stuff. Like he's trying to organize it.
Yeah.
But just mm-hmm. the shapes on the inside. They seem to be moving. I guess just my imagination.
Almost as though one transforms to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's true.
Like they're saying something in that symbolic image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had
secret speech, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I had a weird thought about this image because we were talking about God and matters. You know, how you have the body. Mm-hmm. Brings these messages and instincts and stuff. And if we were trying to, if the unconscious were trying to say something about our body, you know, the cells and all that, we could come up with rude images, I think. I mean, maybe some of that stuff is to do with our physical body today, but I think Jung has said as much, Kathy, because he talks about abstract shapes, the history of images, and he talks about some of those little abstract shapes just normally rising up out of the unconscious in the beginning. And, you know, a lot of the images of early man were just such little marks, you know, hash marks, and things like that, rising up out of the unconscious / the body, I guess you could say.
And even the color series is there. You were saying the energy, that's their complementary colors. They're all related.
Yeah, that's a good point. The opposites give vividness to their partner.
Should I have a stretch?
Yes.
Yeah.